You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we talk to the creator of a New York Times series that invites listeners to overcome their discomfort with disabilities. Now, Jonathan Van Ness has visited homes around the country as part of the TV makeover series Queer Eye. This week, he's visiting Wisconsin, not for makeovers, though. This week, he'll be performing in Madison at the Orpheum Theater on Thursday and Milwaukee at the Pabst Theater on Sunday for his second comedy tour, Imaginary Living Room Olympian. He'll talk about queerness, gymnastics, and self-empowerment. Jonathan Van Ness is a hairstylist, author, and an Emmy-nominated TV personality. Also known as JVN, Jonathan stars in the TV show Queer Eye, has a Netflix show called Getting Curious, and a podcast with the same name. I talked to Jonathan yesterday. Well, tell us the meaning behind your tour name, Imaginary Living Room Olympian. What is that telling us?
You know, it really just came to me in the car one day. And as comedy evolves, often I think sometimes you realize that like the title of the show, like maybe could evolve too. But basically, it's about Imaginary Living Room Olympian is about that this idea of like when we're watching the Olympics or like watching TV, you're like, I could do it so much better, or I could do it like this. I would do this thing. And it's kind of about learning to love that silly voice within all of us when it actually realizes that it can't do that thing and it's way harder than it looks or whatever. So it's really about celebrating yourself, celebrating what to me is queer joy and sharing that with other people. I'm a huge fan of pumpkins. I'm also newly married, and there's been a lot that's happened in the last 2.5 years. So it's all of that in about an hour, plus gymnastics. I do a full-on like gymnastics opening routine. It's a real hoot, and I can't wait to come give it to Madison.
You also, among the many things you have going on, your second book came out. Love That Story, Observations from a Gorgeously Queer Life. Now, you talk about some tough stuff there, surviving abuse, dealing with a positive HIV diagnosis. You know, you confront these things, you don't sweep them under the rug. And yet at the same time, you embrace joy in your life and sharing it. And I see that on Queer Eye with the people you work with there. I don't know, it seems really healthy. How do we do both of those? Like acknowledge the bad stuff and still spread joy?
Yeah, I think that's one thing that I talk about in my first book, Over the Top, is about how some of like my hardest experiences live right next to some of my most joyous ones, and they don't invalidate each other. I think in such a binary society, we are taught a lot of times that like, you know, bad and good are like such far away ideas. And I think that we apply that good and bad binary to emotions like grief, bad, joy, good. And I think that actually like the whole spectrum of emotions can be interesting and can be joyful to process if you can find the right perspective. And so I think that's that idea that like some of your sorrow and your grief can live right next to your joy and some of your greatest, most exciting things. And those experiences don't have to invalidate each other, because actually as humans, we're capable of experiencing such a wide array of emotions. And that's part of like the beauty of life.
That's super interesting. I think there's a motivation to feel guilty though. How can I feel happy and good when this bad thing is happening in this other part of my life? How can I be smiling when I'm also grieving someone? How do we get past, I agree with you, but how do we get past that maybe instinctive feeling of guilt?
I talk about that a lot more and Love That Story, which is my book that came out in April. And I think that the key to that is acknowledging that feeling inside of, or acknowledging the awareness of that guilt and saying like, I'm going to recharge right now. I'm going to experience this joy, whatever it is you need to process that, the grief, to sit with the grief, to process your shame. And then you can go back into the fight. Then you can go back into the advocacy. Then you can go back into the community building and whatever it is that you're really passionate about. And I think that, again, it's like not falling into those binaries of like, you know, how could I possibly feel this joy when there's all of this suffering going on? Like, again, we're expansive enough to allow ourselves to feel both.
And you mentioned a binary society in terms of how we think of good and bad emotions. Also, gender roles. A lot of times we lock into these binary ideas. Now, you're on a show called Queer Eye. Back then it was Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. Do you feel like you have some special insight to share with the rest of us growing up with that queer eye where people looked at you and didn't know quite where you fit in?
Yeah, I mean, I think most people looked at me and knew exactly where I fit in because there wasn't a lot of, like, I really wasn't ever able to, like, fly under the radar, so to speak. But I think that for people that have been othered in any way in society, whether that's, like, due to gender or gender expression or sexual orientation, race, you know, whatever, I think that all of us who have been othered in some way do have just like a different perspective because like you kind of fall outside of the lines. And so I think that's kind of like, again, like a joyful and interesting experience. It's like how as humans we navigate this really tricky layered existence that we all kind of function in. Like, how do we find our joy? How do we find our humor in that? And that's what I'm really curious about. And ultimately, I think that for myself, my kind of mission in life is that like, I want to spread self-acceptance by modeling joy and curiosity. And I do that in my comedy. I do that in my hair care. I do that in my podcast. That's really kind of like what my mission is to model joy and curiosity. And so it's like, how can we process this grief? How can we sit with this discomfort and also allow ourselves to feel joy at the same time? And I'm kind of figuring it out, you know, day by day, honey.
Now, something I'm always curious about you and the team on Queer Eye, when you meet the people you work with, when people watch you, you might be the first openly gay person that they've knowingly encountered in their lives. And that's alien to me because I'm a straight white guy. Odds are anybody I meet has met one of those before. Do you feel like a pressure like, oh, my God, I've got to be an ambassador for this entire group of people?
Sometimes I think that I do, but I don't feel it like for the straight community. I feel it more for the queer community because, I love us and I know that we have our own unique challenges. And also as the queer community, like it's an intersectional one that crosses racial, gender, you know, so many different lines, like, cause the queer community is like as intersectional as it can be. And I think that because of all of those overlapping identities, a lot of us have like different trauma and different kind of like pain bodies that we're coming into our experiences with. And so I just don't ever want to add to that for people. And I know that for certain people within our community, they feel that it like it just we're vocal, like as a community, honey, like if you piss us off, like we're going to let you know. And so when I have disappointed, like, our community, that always, like, hurts worse because I just love our community. And I think I'm out here trying to make more queer liberation and, like, more equity for LGBTQ people and also more understanding amongst, like, everyone. But, you know, I think also, like, as an individual, it's too much pressure to put on oneself because you can't change whole systems, but you can try to model joy and curiosity. And so that's what I usually try to do. But sometimes I do get pissed off on Twitter. I don't know if I'm supposed to say the P word on NPR. I'm so sorry.
It depends on how you say it, interestingly. Another P word I wanted to end with, though, pumpkins you mentioned, and you've mentioned them in your podcast and Instagram lately. It's pumpkin season here in Wisconsin. You're very curious about pumpkins this time of year.
I'm obsessed with pumpkins. I kind of, you know, I don't want to wish time away, but I am excited for spring of 23 so I can have another crack. I only got one pumpkin to adulthood this year. Last year, squash borer vine moths murdered all of my babies.
Oh no!
So there's a good 20 minutes in my set that is devoted to pumpkins. I don't want to blow anyone's socks off, you know, this, you know, early in the day in Wisconsin, but here's the thing. I don't know if you knew this, but pumpkins and all fruits and vegetables, actually, they have like a flower in the process of like becoming a pumpkin. And if I would have known that they had flowers, I would have gotten into growing fruits and vegetables so much earlier. So take that with what you will.
Jonathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Jonathan Van Ness, one of the stars of the TV show Queer Eye. Talked to Jonathan yesterday about the second comedy tour, Imaginary Living Room Olympian, coming through Wisconsin this week. Outside for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a preview of a new WPR podcast launching today called WPR Reports Uprooted, which explores the lives of Cubans in Wisconsin.
Imagine you're a 16-year-old kid thousands of miles from home. You've just stepped off a plane in Wisconsin. For the next few months, you'll be living at an army base. There are strangers, people who don't speak your language. It feels like you're living in prison. Your whole world has been uprooted. You think you're alone, far from family and friends, when suddenly you discover your father, who you've barely had a relationship with, is also at this military base in Wisconsin. This was the reality for Armando Rodriguez, who left his barracks at Fort McCoy daily to meet with his father, Guillermo Rodriguez.
I saw my dad on the other side of the fence, and we talked from afar. And we spent about a month and some like that.
Armando and Guillermo are from Cuba and had to live at Fort McCoy until they found a home in the United States. They were here in Sparta, Wisconsin, because of the Mariel boat lift. For 5 months in 1980, the Cuban government opened its borders and let its residents leave for the U.S. during the height of the Cold War. Almost 125,000 Cubans fled the island and landed in South Florida by boat.
She says more craft are expected to make the journey in what could build into a Dunkirk-like evacuation.
Because of that, the president yesterday declared a state of emergency in southern Florida.
There's a hopeful feeling that they will be allowed to stay in this country and to find jobs.
Many refugees left their homeland to find a better opportunity or escape Fidel Castro's communist government. Some wanted to be reunited with family. Others were plucked from jail and pushed onto boats.
We arrived here in Key West, and then we arrived at Fort McCoy. In Fort McCoy, I stayed for 5 months.
Armando was one of the nearly 15,000 people sent to Fort McCoy in Wisconsin before he found a home. Most of the Cubans who came to Wisconsin left the area after connecting with family or finding sponsors. But some people, like Armando, remained in southern Wisconsin. They created lives here as bus drivers, fathers, and musicians. Now, 42 years later, many of the refugees want to visit Cuba. People like Armando want to go just one more time, but they can't.
I've never been able to visit Cuba. I would like to visit Cuba. I'm not allowed to go. And if I go, I can't come back. I am in the same situation as everyone else who has committed a crime.
His friends in Wisconsin feel the same.
I'm 63 years old. Wow, times go fast, you know. And I haven't given up. I have faith.
The immigration, you know, give us a second chance. Why can those Cubans get a second chance?
Do you want to go back and visit also?
Yeah, I want to go see my mama before she died.
I can go to Cuba.
Oh, you can?
Yeah, I can go. Because I was lucky. I never commit a crime. The only problem is when I want to do my passport, I talk to my sister to send my birth certificate. And when I see my birth certificate, that's wrong. That's not my name.
Because when I try to kill him, I always say, you know, the reason I did it because I want to go back to Cuba.
I'm Maureen McCollum, and this is Uprooted, a new podcast from Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll hear from Cuban Wisconsinites who arrived here more than 40 years ago. These are the unheard voices behind the headlines. What were their lives like in Cuba? What was the journey like across the sea? What has life been like in Wisconsin? And after 40 years, where do they go from here? Subscribe to Uprooted wherever you get your podcasts, and you can see more at WPR.org/uprooted. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we talk to the creator of a new video series that asks viewers to take a close look at their discomfort with disability. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new series from the New York Times asks viewers to imagine what it would be like if they were experiencing blindness or a stutter or other disability. Here's the creator of the series talking about the idea.
We put so much time and effort into making sure that people who are perceived as different understand what it would be like if they were normal. But we rarely ever do the opposite, pushing those who see themselves as normal to understand what it would be like if they were different.
James Robinson is an Emmy-nominated documentary filmmaker and creator of the New York Times opinion video series Adaptability, which invites viewers to overcome their discomfort with disability. His book, Whale Eyes, will be out in 2024. James, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with the first video you made about your own experiences. You have a condition called strabismus that affects the ways your eyes work and the way they look. What made you want to share your story in this particular way?
Yeah, so I've always been fascinated by documentary works, but most of the documentaries I'd been interested in were about people and places far away. And so as a senior in college, my parents actually asked me, what is it like when you see? Because one of my eyes looks straight forward and the other one looks way far off to the side, but then they switch back and forth. And so when they switch, my visual field kind of jumps all of a sudden. And so they asked me to kind of simulate that for them. And so as I started just like a visual simulation, I began to realize there was a lot more here. And so I started digging into kind of a bigger question, which is how I'm seen. And so I kind of interviewed family, and it just started as a school project at university. And then slowly over time kind of grew, and eventually someone at the New York Times saw it. And so I was able to kind of widen the reach for sure through that.
And yeah, you ended up making more documentaries about other people. What are you hoping people take away as they watch people share their stories and their kind of intimate experiences living through their own eyes, as the case may be?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, for almost my entire childhood, most of the disability stories that I saw in the news, whether they were disability profiles in print or in video, oftentimes they were about people with a disability overcoming their condition. And so those stories can be really fascinating, and a lot of people see inspiration in them. But I wanted to focus on something else, which is how all of us can overcome our discomfort with disability. I noted once that I think a lot of people want to overcome their discomfort with disability, and they just don't know how. And so through these videos, I'm kind of trying to teach us all the steps we can take to overcome this discomfort and connect to the person beyond that disability.
I want to give a listen to one of the people who shared a story with you, John, who has a stutter, talking about what it's like to try to have a conversation.
Right after a really long, painful block is momentary relief and lots of exhaustion, and you typically have a large exhale. You may even have to catch your breath. And then you look up the listener, and in a lot of cases of that person may look like they just watched a car accident.
James, can you tell us more about John's story and what he's hoping people he's talking to realize from watching this video?
Yeah, so John has had a stutter his entire life, pretty much his entire life, since he was 3 onwards. And so he's trying to kind of push viewers to become better listeners. Throughout this, in this video, we created this device called the listenometer. And so the premise of the video is that at the beginning of the film, we take out all of John's stutters. So we hear him and he sounds almost completely fluent. Then as the video continues, we slowly start adding back in one type of stutter at a time. So as we're learning about each type of stuttering, we're kind of, our ability to listen is being pushed. And so by the end of it, the hope is that we'll be able to fill in the gaps in John's speech with our own patience. And so it's a level of respect and a level of kind of understanding that John and so many people who stutter as adults have been hoping for. And he was really kind in this interview to put himself in a really vulnerable position, which is in front of the camera, to share what he and so many others are hoping for.
And John and you and the other people you talk to in these videos all talk in one way or another about wanting to connect and people not being able to see them for who they are. Can you talk more about that theme of wanting to connect and overcoming this barrier that the people without these disabilities might create in the first place?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in many ways, this desire to connect is one of the actually few things that unites the disability community. The disability community is so diverse, and there's so many people with so many different conditions. And yet the common thread is that so many times all of us are misunderstood in various ways. And so even that minor misunderstanding, like for me, someone not knowing how to look at my face, not knowing which eye to look into, that can really disrupt your connection and your ability to really understand someone. It may make you not want to have a conversation with that person, or you might interpret their behavior as if they don't want to connect with you. And so the purpose of this series and the purpose of all this work, and I think the kind of drive and the motivation that all of us had, was to overcome this discomfort that inhibits connection. And so in a way, I think all of these stories and all of these videos are really deeply human, because connecting is something that all of us crave.
It's a great place to leave it. James, thanks for sharing this with us.
Thank you.
James Robinson is an Emmy-nominated documentary filmmaker. His book, Whale Eyes, will be out in 2024. He talked to us about the New York Times opinion video series, Adaptability, which asked viewers to overcome their discomfort with disabilities. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the January 6th committee holds a hearing. We'll break down the latest findings, what it all means, and you can join in with your own reactions. You can follow that hearing starting on the Ideas Network. That's tomorrow at noon. And more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then an investigative journalist joins us to share his reporting on claims of ineligible voters in Wisconsin and the lack of evidence for widespread illegal voting. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin is joining three other states to form a regional hydrogen hub. We'll talk about hydrogen's potential in the clean energy landscape and why researchers say some forms could make greenhouse gas emissions worse. First, Wisconsin elections have been under intense scrutiny since 2020, with many conservative groups making claims about voter fraud that in most cases haven't yielded significant evidence. More recently, the attention has turned to the state's voter rolls, where activists have sought to uncover ineligible voters who may have participated in elections. Our next guest looked into these claims and investigations, found that there are some gaps in the system and some things that might need to be fixed, but no evidence of widespread numbers of ineligible voters that could affect the results of elections. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered these claims about ineligible voters? What questions do you have? Do you work as a clerk yourself? What kind of things go into managing voter rolls in your community? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Matthew DeFore is the State House Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Watch, the news arm of the nonpartisan nonprofit Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. He previously covered state and local government at the Wisconsin State Journal for 16 years. Matt, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, great to be here.
Before we dig into the complaints and the things you found, can you talk about the voter rolls? Who is in charge of saying this person is an eligible voter, this person should be taken off the list?
Sure. There are, in the last presidential election, there were 3.2 million people who cast votes. And the state keeps track of a voter roll list, which has more people than that, because they keep track of all sorts of people, including those who are no longer eligible to vote, people who are dead. And it is up to the local clerks. We have 1,800 election officials in the state who have to make sure that they are staying on top of all the people who are registering to vote and who may no longer be eligible to vote because of issues such as they have a felony on their record and they're still serving a sentence, or they're deceased, or as we found in our investigation, some other examples.
And we've seen, and you report on this, widespread efforts to raise questions about who is on these lists, who should be bumped off. Can you talk about some of the groups involved in these efforts to challenge local clerks and their voter rolls?
Sure. There's a few groups that we found, and this is not something that's limited to just Wisconsin. There are groups across the country, conservative groups, who are trying to find these sort of holes in the election system. In Wisconsin, a couple of these groups worked on former Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman's investigation of the 2020 election. I talked specifically to Ron Hoyer of the Wisconsin Voter Alliance. There's some other groups, but these were folks who they were raising questions about some of the eligibility of voters as part of that investigation, which has, of course, now been shut down.
One of the main categories you look at in this new Wisconsin Watch piece is people under court-ordered guardianships that specify that they are no longer eligible to vote. It gets a little complicated. Can you talk us through who this might cover?
So in Wisconsin, you are guaranteed the right to vote with some exceptions. I mentioned felons who are currently serving a sentence, but there are people who a court can determine may have a cognitive disability and they may not be eligible to vote because a court has decided that. I do not have a full list of the number of people statewide who would fall under that category, but it's obviously a changing number because some of those people pass away. Some people can have their rights restored. And what we found in our investigation is that the problem that this Wisconsin Voter Alliance had when they looked at these folks, and it's the same problem that the Gableman investigation had, is that they were conflating people under a court-ordered guardianship with people who have additionally had their right to vote taken away. And not everybody under a guardianship is ineligible to vote. And that's a really important point that their investigation seemed to gloss over.
Right, and that's a really key point I wanted to bring up. When we hear reports claiming there are thousands of people under guardianships who therefore shouldn't be able to vote, many of those thousands of people might in fact be under guardianships, but still have their voting rights intact. Do I have that about right?
Yeah, just to kind of give some perspective on it, I talked to Dane County Clerk of Courts Carlo Esqueda. He pointed out to not just us, but also to the Wisconsin Voter Alliance, that there were about 1,000 people in Dane County adjudicated as incompetent to vote between 2016 and 2021. But if you take that list and you strip out everybody who is still allowed to vote and who's still living, or you take out people who are no longer living, the number went from about 1,000 down to 281. So they were coming up with this number of thousands. But, you know, Carlos showed that that number is smaller. But that number itself is also misleading because not all of those people may have registered to vote at any point. So they might not even be in the voter system.
Talking to Matt DeFore from Wisconsin Watch about his new report on challenges to voter rolls in communities around the state. You could join in with your questions, maybe your experiences, maybe challenging something like this, or if you've encountered a guardianship in your own family, you're curious about what that means about voting rights. If you've worked in the system yourself, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Matt, again, your reporting found no widespread problems, apparently, that might have swung an election. That said, there were people who slipped through the cracks in some ways in small numbers that you've discovered so far. What did you find?
So there was something surprising here. The Gableman investigation did identify one person in particular in Outagamie County. The report didn't identify who that was, but we were able to find out that person through other means. And this person had voted in November of 2020 and April of 2021, even though she had been adjudicated in February of 2020. And so this set off, I think, a lot of alarm bells for conservatives. But when we dug into that specific case, we didn't find anything suggesting more than perhaps an administrative error for the handoff from, I mean, it's essentially a complicated process for how somebody who is adjudicated incompetent by a court, then that information is passed along to the local clerk. And it looked, there's about three different handoffs that have to happen. And in that case, it looked like the handoff didn't happen. We haven't exactly pinpointed where, but she was still on the voter rolls in November 2020 and April 2021. And we know who signed her absentee ballot. It wasn't somebody, you know,
as a witness.
Yeah, as a witness. I'm sorry, right. Who signed her. We know it was a nursing home employee in 2020. We know it was a local clerk in 2020-21. They did not have the information or had not accessed it in the WEC files until April of 2022. And so that's how that person voted. But just to add to that, what was surprising is that when we asked Dane County Clerk Scott McDonald if he would look at their list of people who are adjudicated ineligible to vote, he looked at 20 of the 1,000 people in Dane County, and he did find two people on that sample who were still active. And I think that caused enough alarm that he's now looking at all 1,000 people on their list to see how many might still be active. One of those two people had cast a vote in April 2019 after being adjudicated in November 2018.
We're talking to Wisconsin Watch reporter Matt DeFore about investigations into Wisconsin's voter rules that turned up minimal evidence of illegally cast votes, but not zero. We'll talk about what the Elections Commission and clerks are doing in response to this coming up, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one had to work through voter eligibility issues yourself? What was your experience like? Do you live or work at a nursing home or assisted living facility? What have you seen when it comes to voting? What questions do you have about this complicated process that's become front and center, at least in some political circles? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Wisconsin Watch State House Bureau Chief Matt DeFore. With us today, sharing his reporting on Wisconsin's voter rolls, challenges to them from some conservative groups, and what happens when people are adjudicated ineligible to vote. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have concerns about this system, questions about it? Is this something that's come up maybe in your own family, somebody being judged not able to vote anymore? How did that work on a practical level for you? What questions do you have? What experiences do you have maybe working in the election system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Matt, let's talk about responses to this. Again, as you said, not widespread numbers, it looks like, of people ineligibly voting, but not zero numbers. I think everybody probably wants to make sure things go right. First of all, from clerks, as you mentioned in Dane County, what kind of efforts are they making to make sure that handoff of information, the declaration of ineligibility, the Elections Commission, the local clerks are all on the same page?
So the way the process is supposed to work is that what's known as the register and probate in a county court system will get that information that somebody has been deemed ineligible to vote. And they will pass it along to the Wisconsin Elections Commission. One thing we found is that they do that through the snail mail, apparently. That information then needs to be uploaded to a list that the WEC maintains of everybody who has been adjudicated incompetent to vote. And as you can imagine, there are people on that separate list who they've never registered to vote. So they need to keep track of those folks in case they ever try to register. But in this, what we seem to be finding is that there could be cases where that information may not be input correctly, for example, into the WEC files. So a local clerk may miss that information. It could be for somebody in a different city where they're adjudicated, and then when they're being asked to vote in a nursing home in a different county, that local clerk may not have connected the dots that's the same person. One thing we also found with this investigation is that in the 2020 election, of course, the special voting deputies that clerks' offices send into nursing homes were not allowed to go in. And so we had a lot of nursing homes handling the voting. And so that, you know, again, can be another layer where there's just a missed opportunity to catch something like this. But again, it's a very small number. So,
and then at the Wisconsin Elections Commission itself, what kind of changes, tweaks are they considering, enacting, talking about, or deadlocking on?
Yeah, and there's a lot of deadlock lately. They are looking into this issue. So we had found that in their communication with the legislature, this conservative group that brought this attention to legislature prompted them to ask WEC They said that they have been checking into this issue, but they also said that while they acknowledge there could be some of these missed cases, it would require a legislative fix. The legislature would need to specifically tell them how to do the system differently and perhaps more efficiently to make sure that these steps aren't missed. And they have a more efficient system, for example, tracking felons or people who have moved. But in this particular case, it's a very, you know, there's, again, that's multiple steps where human error can be injected at any of those steps. And that's how you might miss, you know, could be dozens of people in the state.
One big difference here, and this comes up in your reporting, is if I'm a felon currently serving a sentence, that's a public record. People are allowed to know that. There's health information involved here for someone who's been declared incompetent to vote. Can you talk about how that affects people trying to get and share this information?
Right. So and it's not just even a health issue. I originally thought this might be HIPAA, but state law specifically bars court officials from revealing the names and addresses of people deemed incompetent to the public. The Wisconsin voter line specifically is suing registers and probate in 13 counties to make this information public because they want to check all these names against the voter rolls. But those, you know, the one county's already ruled against them. We'll see if any of those counties, you know, allow that information to be public. But yeah, it's not quite the same as public criminal information. This is people whose information is protected.
Right, and the concerns about particularly vulnerable people here. I mean, they might be very vulnerable to a scammer who gets their hands on a list of people in this situation.
You know, that's an interesting irony here, is that these groups are concerned about that very thing happening, and yet they're suing in a way that could make it easier for someone to do that. Right now, I mean, this is part of why we know there's not some grand plan or grand plot here, is because this information is protected. And so I'm not sure how somebody would even go about trying to, scam the system. Especially if it's kept private right now.
Let's bring on a caller. Andy is with us in Manitowoc. Andy, hi.
Yes, I wanted to ask about a situation that I know of personally, that in Milwaukee, there was a multi-denominational church group that was asked to go around to nursing homes and pick up ballots and delivering to the multiple drop boxes. And they were specifically told, you know, don't put more than 5 in each drop box. Well, I don't know what that meant, but they were told that specifically. So they had to go to, you know, maybe 2 stops or 3 stops, depending on how many ballots they had. I was wondering what your guest had to say about that.
Andy, thanks for sharing that. A lot of stories going around. Do we have any firsthand stories like that you've encountered, Matt?
Not that story specifically, so I really couldn't comment on what exactly is happening here. But, you know, again, it does sound like the type of story that a lot of conservatives have been sort of promoting, this idea of people dropping off ballots at drop boxes. You know, the evidence that such things are happening has been dismissed by, you know, people all the way up to the former Attorney General of the United States, Bill Barr. So I'm not sure what to make of that.
Then looking ahead, Matt, what kind of next steps are you watching for in this story?
So we do want to get an answer to this question. How many people are affected by this? I think doing so helps the public to understand, you know, what it is we're talking about. And again, the unfortunate thing about the Gableman investigation is that it kind of left a lot of these questions unanswered. You know, how many people are we talking about? Is this thousands, as this conservative group has, you know, put out in its communications to local clerks all over the state? Or is it, you know, a smaller sort of, still worth noting, but not concerning maybe to the broader public about how our elections are run? And I think that's what we want to get to the bottom of. I think as we continue to talk with the Dane County Clerk, with the Wisconsin Elections Commission, we want them to be able to say, you know, we've identified the issue, here's how we're going to fix it going forward.
Matt, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob, for having me.
Matthew DeFore is the State House Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Watch, part of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. He's with us today to talk about his reporting on conservative groups' claims of ineligible voters participating in Wisconsin elections at a large scale, and then looking into the process when somebody is declared unable to vote, what happens, what kind of tweaks are needed. reckless driving is a growing problem in Wisconsin. Statewide traffic fatalities have increased each year since 2019. Towns and cities around the state are trying to combat reckless driving in many ways, including redesigning the roads themselves. But their options are limited on busy urban highways where state policies can override local efforts. Jonah Chester reports.
As a kid living along West Fond du Lac Avenue in Milwaukee, Tristan Thomas saw plenty of reckless driving. A police officer would park blocks away from his home to catch cars barreling down the road.
And he would sit there for like 8 to 10 hours every day, pulling people over constantly because they're just flying down the street with no regard for anyone else.
Thomas is 40 and lives in Appleton now, but he's tragically aware reckless driving on Fond du Lac hasn't gotten better since he was young. On the morning of March 12th, his sister Dwinetta Thomas was making a left turn at the intersection of Fond du Lac and Congress Street. A driver in oncoming traffic hit her vehicle. She later died of her injuries.
It's still incredibly hard to believe that she isn't here. We'll have a messenger call where, you know, everybody's got the video cameras on and we're looking at each other, and then it's just, you know, you're waiting for her to come on, and it's like, oh, she's not. She's not coming on anymore.
Thomas says Fond du Lac Avenue looks essentially the same as when he was a kid. That's in spite of efforts to make change. The road runs northwest from downtown Milwaukee until it connects with Interstate 41 at the edge of the city. The municipal street is part of State Highway 145, making it what's known as a connecting highway. On roads like this, the Wisconsin Department of Transportation gets final say over any infrastructure changes. That includes traffic calming measures like narrowing pedestrian crossings and reducing lane widths to encourage drivers to slow down. WSDOT gives high priority to traffic flow when considering proposed changes. Advocates like Jordan Morales say that priority hinders new road safety projects. Morales is the vice president of Milwaukee's Sherman Park Community Association.
The Milwaukee Department of Public Works, they're more concerned or becoming more concerned with pedestrian and bicycle infrastructure, and they're actually more concerned about slowing cars down. So you've got kind of two competing philosophies.
A city report from 2019 found 16 of Milwaukee's 25 most crash-prone intersections sat on or near Fond du Lac Avenue or Capitol Drive, another state-connecting highway. And from January 2017 to July 2022, 42 people died in traffic collisions along the two roads. That's about 11% of the city's total traffic deaths during that time. Milwaukee officials say WSDOT has allowed some changes on connecting highways. Those include protected turn lanes, as well as concrete bumpouts and expanded medians to shorten crosswalks at busy intersections. But Gerald Krushke, Milwaukee's interim commissioner of public works, says WSDOT has rejected more ambitious proposals like narrowing or eliminating lanes.
I think they're starting to understand the needs that we have in the city, which is a good start. I still think we have a long way to go.
Stephen Flottmeyer is the planning chief for WSDOT's southwestern region. He says the department considers the needs of all road users when weighing new projects, but he acknowledges WSDOT typically approaches rural and urban highways with the same set of goals, which includes traffic flow.
The only difference is within the connecting highways, the city plays a much bigger part in the conversation.
Dwinetta Thomas's family is among those who would like to see that relationship evolve more quickly. Tristan says they think changes to make Fond du Lac Avenue safer could save families from what they're going through.
It's a gigantic loss for our family. It's a gigantic loss for the community in which she served, and we just have to make sure that nobody else's bright light gets snuffed out.
Dwinetta had moved to Sheboygan, but was still in Milwaukee often.
The day she was killed, she was actually dropping someone off at a store. So I think it's apropos that she was out helping someone, and then that happened. So she was definitely loved.
Dwinetta left behind two adult children and four siblings. Jonah Chester, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we'll look at clean hydrogen fuel and whether it has a big role to play in the move away from fossil fuels. And the U.S. House Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol is holding a public hearing tomorrow. We'll bring you live NPR coverage starting at noon. Listen in here on Wisconsin Public Radio or online at WPR.org. And we'll talk about what comes out of that hearing tomorrow on Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.